past his knees. The two shotguns were triangulated on Roscoe and Charlie Hubble. They were tiny figures 40 feet below me. They were being made to work. Roscoe had a snow shovel, one of those curved things they use in the snow states to clear their driveways. She was pushing drifts of dollars toward Charlie. Charlie was scooping them into air conditioner cartons and tamping them in firmly with a garden rake. There was a line of sealed boxes behind the two women. In front of them was the huge stockpile. They toiled away far below me, dwarfed like two ants below the mountain of dollar bills. I held my breath. I was transfixed. It was an utterly unbelievable sight. I could see Kleiner's black pickup truck. It was backed in just inside the roller door. Next to it was Teal's white Cadillac. Both were big automobiles, but they were nothing next to the mountain of cash. They were just like toys on the beach. It was awesome. It was a fantastic scene from a fairy tale, like a huge underground cavern in an emerald mine from some glittering fable, all brightly lit by the 100 arc lights, tiny figures far below. I couldn't believe it. Hubble had said $1 million in singles was a hell of a sight. I was looking at 40 million. It was the height of the drift that did it to me. It towered way up, 10 times higher than the two tiny figures working at floor level, higher than a house, higher than two houses. It was incredible. It was a huge warehouse, and it was full of a solid mass of money, full of 40 million genuine $1 bills. The two women were moving with the dullness of extreme fatigue, like exhausted troopers at the end of some cruel maneuver, asleep on their feet, moving about automatically while their minds screamed for rest. They were packing armful after armful of dollars from the gigantic stockpile into the boxes. It was a hopeless task. The Coast Guard retreat had caught Kleiner by surprise. He wasn't ready. The warehouse was hopelessly jammed. Roscoe and Charlie were being worked like exhausted slaves. Teal and Kleiner were watching them like overseers, listlessly, like they knew they were at the end of the road. The enormous drift of cash was going to bury them. It was going to engulf them and choke them to death. I heard the faint clang of Finlay's feet on the fire escape. I crawled back out of the office and met him on the metal platform outside. "They're back at the car," he whispered to me. "How we doing here?" "Two shotguns out and ready," I whispered. "Roscoe and Charlie look okay." He glanced in toward the bright light and the faint noises. "What are they all doing in there?" he asked me in a whisper. "Come take a look," I said softly. "But hold your breath." We crawled in together, crawled over the floor to the windows, slowly popped our heads up. Finlay looked down at the fantastic scene below. He stared down for a long time. His eyes flicked all over the place, ended up staring at me, holding his breath.
"Christ," he whispered.
I nodded him back out. We crawled to the fire escape platform.
"Christ," he whispered again. "Can you believe that?"
I shook my head. "No," I whispered back to him. "I can't believe it."
"What are we going to do?" he asked me.
I held my hand up to make Finlay wait on the platform, crawled back inside, and peered down through the window. I looked all over the place, looked at where Teal was sitting, looked at the office inner door, checked Kleiner's field of fire, guessed where Roscoe and Charlie might end up. I calculated angles and estimated distances. I came up with one definite conclusion. It was a hell of a problem. Old Man Kleiner was the nearest person to us. Roscoe and Charlie were working between him and Teal. Teal was the dangerous one because he was at the far end of the warehouse. When I came out at the top of the inside stairs, they were all four going to look up at me. Kleiner was going to raise his shotgun. Teal was going to raise his shotgun. They were both going to shoot at me. Kleiner had a straight shot, 60 degrees upward, like a duck hunter. But Roscoe and Charlie were down there between Teal and me. Teal was going to be shooting on a fairly shallow angle. He was already perched 10 feet up the slope. He would be looking for another 30 feet of elevation from a distance of 100 feet. A shallow angle, maybe 15 or 20 degrees. His big Ithaca was designed to cover a much wider spread than 15 or 20 degrees. His shot was going to catch the women in a murderous spray. His shot was going to kill them. When Teal looked up at me and fired, Roscoe and Charlie were going to die. I crawled back out of the office and joined Finlay on the fire escape, bent down and picked up the plastic bottle of gasoline, handed it to him with the matchbook, leaned close, and told him what to do. We whispered together, and he set off slowly back down the long flight of metal steps. I crawled through the office and laid the Desert Eagle carefully on the floor by the inner door, safety off. Crawled back under the window, eased my head up, and waited. 3 minutes went by. I was staring at the far end of the roller door, staring and waiting, watching the crack between the bottom of the door and the concrete, right at the far end, diagonally opposite me across the whole huge space. I stared and waited. 4 minutes had gone by. The tiny figures below toiled on, Roscoe and Charlie stuffing boxes under Teal's careful gaze. Kleiner clambering his way over the mountainside to kick a new river of dollars down the slope toward the women. 5 minutes had gone by. Kleiner had put his shotgun down. He was 30 feet away from it, scrabbling in the pile, starting a small avalanche which rolled down to Roscoe's feet. 6 minutes had gone by. 7. Then I saw the dark, wet stain of gasoline seeping under the roller door. It flowed into a semicircular pool. It kept coming. It reached the bottom of the enormous dune of dollars, 10 feet below where Teal was sprawled on the lower slopes. It kept growing outward, a dark stain on the concrete. Kleiner was still working, 40 feet across the mountain from Teal, still 30 feet away from his weapon. I crawled back to the inner door, eased the handle down. The door came free of the catch. I picked up my gun, eased the door, halfway open, crawled back to the window, watched the growing pool of gasoline. I had been afraid Teal would smell it straight away. That was the weak part of the plan. But he couldn't smell it, because the whole shed was full of a powerful, appalling stink. It had hit me like a hammer as soon as I opened the door, a heavy, sour, greasy smell. The smell of money. Millions and millions of crumpled and greasy dollar bills were seeping out the stink of sweaty hands and sour pockets. The smell hung in the air. It was the same smell I had noticed in the empty boxes in Sherman Stoller's garage, the sour smell of used money. Then I saw the flame bloom under the door. Finley had dropped the match. It was a low blue flame. It raced in under the door and bloomed out over the wide stain like a flower opening. It reached the bottom of the huge green mountain. I saw Teal snap his head around and stare at it, frozen in horror. I stepped to the door and squeezed out, aimed the gun, braced my wrist against the balcony railing, pulled the trigger and blew Teal's head off 100 feet away. The big bullet caught him in the temple and exploded his skull all over the metal siding behind him. Then everything went wrong. I saw it happen in that terrible slow motion you get when your mind is racing faster than you can move. My gun hand was drifting left to track Kleiner on his way back to his own weapon. But Kleiner dived to the right. He launched himself in a desperate leap down the mountainside to the spot where Teal had dropped his shotgun. He wasn't going back for his own gun. He was going to use Teal's weapon. He was going to use the same lethal geometry that Teal would have used. I saw my hand reverse its direction. It was cutting a graceful, smooth arc through the air just behind Kleiner, tumbling and sliding down in a great spray of dollars. Then I heard the crash of the staff door bursting open below. The crash of the door fought with the echo of the roar of the shot which had killed Teal, and I saw Picard stagger onto the warehouse floor. His jacket was gone, and I saw blood soaking his enormous white shirt. I saw him taking giant, lurching strides toward the women. His head was turning, and his right arm was windmilling upward to point at me. I saw his .38 dwarfed in his hand. 100 feet from him, I saw Kleiner reach Teal's shotgun where it had fallen and buried itself in the cash pile. I saw the blue flames bursting upward at the bottom of the huge dune of dollars. I saw Roscoe spinning slowly to look up at me. I saw Charlie Hubble spinning slowly the other way to look at Teal. I saw her start to scream. Her hands were slowly moving up to her face, and her mouth was opening and her eyes were closing. The sound of her screaming drifted gently up to me and fought the dying echo of the Desert Eagle's bullet and the crash of the door. I grasped the balcony railing in front of me and hauled myself one-handed toward it, swung my gun hand vertically down and fired, and hit Picard through the right shoulder a tiny fraction before his .38 came to rest on me. I saw him hit the floor in an explosion of blood as I hauled my aim back over to Kleiner. My mind was detached, just treating it like a purely mechanical problem. I had locked my shoulder so that the big automatic's recoil would kick it upward. That won me a tiny fraction as I hauled the sights over to the other end of the warehouse. I felt the smack in my palm as the burnt gases hurled the spent shell case out and crashed the next bullet in. Kleiner had the Ithaca barrel on the way up in a slow-motion flurry of dollar bills, and he was pumping the shell. I heard the double crunch-crunch of the mechanism over the roar of the shot that had stopped Picard. My detached mind computed that Kleiner would fire just slightly above the horizontal to hit me with the top of the spray, and that the bottom of the spray would decapitate Roscoe and Charlie. It told me my bullet would take a hair over 700ths of a second to cover the length of the warehouse, and that I should aim high up on his right side to rotate the shotgun away from the women. After that, my brain just shut down, handed me all that information, and sat back to mock my attempt to haul my arm up faster than Kleiner could haul the Ithaca's barrel up. It was a race in agonizing slow motion. I was leaning half off the balcony, slowly bringing my arm up as if I was lifting an enormous weight. 100 feet away, Kleiner was slowly raising the shotgun barrel as if it was mired in molasses. They came up together, slowly, inch by inch, degree by degree, up and up. It took forever. It took the whole of my lifetime. Flames were bursting and exploding at the bottom of the mountain. They were spreading upward and outward through the money. Kleiner's yellow teeth were parting in a wolfish smile. Charlie was screaming. Roscoe was slowly floating down toward the concrete floor like gossamer. My arm and Kleiner's shotgun were traveling slowly upward together, inch by ghastly inch. My arm got there first. I fired and hit Kleiner in the right upper chest, and the huge .44 slug hurled him off his feet. The Ithaca barrel whipped sideways as he pulled the trigger. The shotgun boomed and fired point blank into the enormous mountain of money. The air was instantly thick with tiny scraps of paper. Shreds and fragments of dollar bills were blasted all over the place. They swirled like a thick blizzard and burst into flames as they settled into the fire. Then time restarted, and I was racing down the stairs to the warehouse floor. Flames were ripping through the greasy mountain faster than a man could run. I fought through the smoke and caught Roscoe under one arm and Charlie under the other, spun them off their feet and carried them back toward the staircase. I could feel a gale of oxygen sucking in under the roller door to feed the fire. The whole huge shed was bursting into flame. The enormous dune of money was exploding. I was running flat out for the stairs, dragging the two women with me. I ran straight into Picard. He reared up off the floor in front of me, and the impact sent me sprawling. He stood there, like a wounded giant, bellowing in fury. His right shoulder was shattered and pumping blood. His shirt was soaked in appalling crimson. I staggered up off the floor, and he hit me with his left hand. It was a shuddering impact, and it rocked me back. He followed it up with another swinging left that hit me on the arm and sent the Desert Eagle clattering over the concrete. The fire was billowing around us, and my lungs were burning, and I could hear Charlie Hubble screaming hysterically. Picard had lost his revolver. He stood unsteadily in front of me, rocking back and forth, swinging his massive left arm ready for another blow. I threw myself inside the swing and hit him in the throat with my elbow. I hit him harder than I had ever hit anything before in my life. But he just shook himself and stepped nearer, swung his enormous left fist, and knocked me sideways into the fire. I was breathing pure smoke as I rolled out. Picard stepped nearer. He was standing in a burning drift of money. He leaned forward and kicked me in the chest, like being hit by a truck. My jacket caught fire. I tore it off and hurled it at him, but he just swatted it aside and swung his leg back for the kick that was going to kill me. Then his body started jerking like somebody was behind him, hitting him with a hammer. I saw Finley standing there, shooting Picard with the handgun he had gotten from the station house. He fired six shots into Picard's back. Picard turned and looked at him, took a step toward him. Finley's gun clicked empty. I scrabbled for my big Israeli automatic, swept it up off the hot concrete, and shot Picard through the back of the head. His skull exploded under the impact of the huge bullet. His legs crumpled, and he started falling. I fired my last four shells into him before he hit the floor. Finley grabbed Charlie and raced away through the flames. I hauled Roscoe off the floor and hurled myself at the stairs and dragged her up and out through the office, out and down the fire escape as the flames boiled out through the door after us. We hurled ourselves through the gap in the fence. I hoisted Roscoe high into my arms and ran across the field to the tree. Behind us, the superheated air blew the roof off the shed, and flames burst 100 feet into the night sky. All around us, burning fragments of dollar bills were drifting down. The warehouse was blasting like a furnace. I could feel the heat on my back, and Roscoe was beating away the flaming paper that was landing on us. We raced for the tree, didn't stop, raced on to the road 200 yards, 100 yards. Behind me I could hear screeching and tearing as the metal shed distorted and burst. Up ahead, Hubble was standing next to the Bentley. He flung open the rear doors and raced for the driver's seat. The four of us crammed into the back, and Hubble stamped on the gas. The car shot forward and the doors slammed shut. The children were in the front, both screaming. Charlie was screaming. Roscoe was screaming. I noticed, with a kind of detached curiosity, that I was screaming too. Hubble blasted a mile down the road. Then he jammed to a stop, and we untangled ourselves and fell out of the car, stumbled about, hugged and kissed and cried, staggering about in the dirt at the side of the old county road. The four Hubbles clung together. Roscoe and Finley and I clung together. Then Finley was dancing around, yelling and laughing like a madman. All his old Boston reserve was gone. Roscoe was huddled in my arms. I was watching the fire a mile away. It was getting worse. It was getting higher. It was spreading to the farmers' sheds next in line. Bags of nitrogen fertilizer and drums of tractor oil were exploding like bombs. We all turned to watch the inferno and the explosions. Seven of us, in a ragged line on the road. From a mile away we watched the firestorm. Great spouts of flame were leaping 1,000 feet. Exploding oil drums were blowing up like mortar shells. The night sky was full of burning banknotes like 1,000,000 orange stars. It looked like hell on earth.
"Christ," Finley said, "did we do that?"
"You did that, Finley," I said. "You dropped the match." We laughed and hugged. We danced and laughed and slapped each other's backs. We swung the children up in the air and hugged them and kissed them. Hubble hugged me and pounded me on the back. Charlie hugged me and kissed me. I lifted Roscoe off her feet and kissed her, long and hard, on and on. She wrapped her legs around my waist and locked her arms behind my head. We kissed like we would die if we stopped. Then I drove slowly and quietly back to town. Finlay and Roscoe squeezed together with me in the front. The four Hubbles squeezed into the back. Soon as we lost the glow of the fire behind us, we picked up the glow of the station house burning in front of us. I slowed as we drove past, burning fiercely. It was going to burn to the ground. Hundreds of people were milling about in a ragged circle, watching it. Nobody was doing anything about it. I picked up speed again, and we rolled through the silent town, made the right up Beckman opposite the statue of old Caspar Thiel, jinked around the silent white church, drove the mile up to the familiar white mailbox at number 25. I turned in and wound my way up the driveway, stopped at the door just long enough for the Hubbles to spill out, hauled the old car around and backed down the driveway, rolled down Beckman again and stopped at the bottom. "Out, Finley," I said. He grinned and got out, walked off into the night. I drove across the bottom of Main Street and coasted down to Roscoe's place, stopped on her drive. We stumbled into the house, dragged the chest of drawers down the hallway and shoved it up against the splintered door, sealed ourselves off from the world. 34. It didn't work out for Roscoe and me. It never really stood a chance. There were too many problems. It lasted a hair over 24 hours, and then it was over. I was back on the road. It was 5 o'clock Sunday morning when we hauled that chest of drawers over and shoved it up against the broken door. We were both exhausted, but the adrenaline was still boiling through us, so we couldn't sleep. Instead, we talked. And the more we talked, the worse it got. Roscoe had been a prisoner the best part of 64 hours. She hadn't been mistreated. She told me they hadn't touched her. She had been terrified, but they had just worked her like a slave. Thursday, Picard had driven her off in his car. I had watched them go. I had waved them off. She had updated him with our progress. 1 mile up the county road, he had pulled his gun on her, disarmed her, handcuffed her, driven her up to the warehouse. He'd driven right in through the roller door, and she'd been put straight to work with Charlie Hubble. The two of them had been in there, working the whole time I'd been sitting under the highway watching the place. Roscoe herself had unloaded the red truck the Kleiner kid had brought in. Then I had followed it out to that truck stop near Memphis and wondered why the hell it was empty. Charlie Hubble had been in there working 5.5 days, since Monday evening. Kleiner had already started panicking by then. The Coast Guard retreat was coming too soon for him. He knew he had to work fast to clear the stockpile. So Picard had brought the Hubbles straight to the warehouse. Kleiner had made the hostages work. They had slept just a few hours a night, lying down on the dune of dollars, handcuffed to the bottom of the office stairs. Saturday morning, when his son and the two gate men hadn't come back, Kleiner had gone crazy. Now he had no staff at all. So he worked the hostages around the clock. They didn't sleep at all Saturday night, just plowed on with the hopeless task of trying to box up the huge pile. They were falling further and further behind. Every time an incoming truck spilled a new load out on the warehouse floor, Kleiner had become more and more frantic. So Roscoe had been a slave the best part of 3 days, in fear for her life, in danger, exhausted and humiliated for 3 long days. And it was my fault. I told her that. The more I told her, the more she said she didn't blame me. It was my fault, I was saying. It wasn't your fault, she was saying. I'm sorry, I was saying. Don't be, she was telling me. We listened to each other. We accepted what was being said. But I still thought it was my fault. Wasn't 100% sure she didn't think so, too, despite what she was saying. We didn't fall out about it, but it was the first faint sign of a problem between us. We showered together in her tiny stall, stayed in there the best part of an hour. We were soaping off the stink of the money and the sweat and the fire, and we were still talking. I was telling her about Friday night, the ambush in the storm up at Hubble's place. I told her all about it. I told her about the bags with the knives and the hammer and the nails. I told her what I had done to the 5 of them. I thought she'd be happy about it. And that was the second problem. Not a big deal as we stood there with the hot water beating down on us, but I heard something in her voice, just a tiny tremor. Not shock or disapproval. Just a hint of a question that maybe I had gone too far. I could hear it in her voice. I felt somehow I'd done it all for her and Joe. I hadn't done it because I had wanted to do it. It was Joe's business, and it was her town, and these were her people. I'd done it because I'd seen her trying to melt into her kitchen wall, crying like her heart was breaking. I'd done it for Joe and Molly. At the same time as feeling I needed no justification at all, I had been justifying it to myself like that. It didn't feel like a problem at the time. The shower loosened us up, steamed some glow back into us. We went to bed, left the drapes open. It was a glorious day. The sun was up in a bright blue sky, and the air looked fresh and clean. It looked like it should look, like a new day. We made love with great tenderness, great energy, great joy. If somebody had told me then that I'd be back on the road the next morning, I'd have thought they were crazy. I told myself there were no problems. I was imagining them. And if there were problems, there were good reasons for them. Maybe the after effects of the stress and the adrenaline. Maybe the deep fatigue. Maybe because Roscoe had been a hostage, maybe she was reacting like a lot of hostages do. They feel some kind of a faint jealousy against anybody who hadn't been a hostage with them. Some kind of a faint resentment. Maybe that was feeding the guilt I was carrying for letting her get captured in the first place. Maybe a lot of things. I fell asleep, certain we'd wake up happy and I'd stay there forever. We did wake up happy. We slept through until late afternoon. Then we spent a gorgeous couple of hours with the afternoon sun streaming in the window, dozing and stretching, kissing and laughing. We made love again. We were fueled up with the joy of being safe and alive and alone together. It was the best lovemaking we ever had. It was also the last. But we didn't know that at the time. Roscoe took the Bentley up to Eno's for some food. She was gone an hour and came back with news. She'd seen Finley. She was talking about what was going to happen next. That was the big problem. It made the other tiny problems look like nothing at all.
"You should see the station house," she said. "Nothing left, more than a foot high."
She put the food on a tray and we ate it, sitting on the bed. Fried chicken.
"All four warehouses burned down," she said. "There was debris exploding all over the highway. The state police got involved. They had to get fire trucks all the way from Atlanta and Macon."
"State police are involved?" I said. She laughed.
"Everybody's involved," she said. "It sort of snowballed. The Atlanta fire chief called in the bomb squad because of the explosions, because he didn't know for sure what they were. The bomb squad can't go anywhere without notifying the FBI in case it's terrorism, so the Bureau is interested. Then the National Guard got involved this morning."
"The National Guard," I said. "Why?"
"This is the best part," she said. "Finley says when the roof blew off the warehouse last night, the sudden updraft of air blew the money all over the place. Remember those burning pieces that kept landing on us? There are millions of dollar bills all over the place, miles around. The wind blew them everywhere, in the fields, all over the highway. Most of them are partially burned, of course, but some of them aren't. Soon as the sun came up, thousands of people came out of nowhere, swarming around all over the place, picking all the money up. So the National Guard was ordered in to disperse the crowds."
I ate some food, thought about it. "Governor calls in the guard, right?" I asked her. She nodded, mouth full of chicken wing.
"The governor's involved," she said. "He's in town right now. And Finley called the Treasury Department because of Joe. They're sending a team down here. I told you it sort of snowballed."
What the hell else? I said.
Big problems here, of course, she said. Rumors are flying around. Everybody seems to know the foundation is finished. Finley says half of them are pretending they never knew what was going on, and the other half are mad as hell their $1,000 a week is going to stop. You should have seen old Eno when I picked up the food. Looked like he's furious.
Finley worried? I said.
He's okay, she said. Busy, of course. We're down to a four-person police department. Finley, me, Stevenson, and the desk man. Finley says that's half of what we need because of the crisis, but twice as many as we can afford because the foundation subsidy is going to stop. But anyway, there's nothing anybody can do about hiring and firing without the mayor's approval. And we haven't got a mayor anymore, have we?
I sat there on the bed eating. The problems started bearing down on me. I hadn't really seen them clearly before, but I was seeing them now. A huge question was forming in my mind. It was a question for Roscoe. I wanted to ask it straight away and get her honest, spontaneous response. I didn't want to give her any time to think about her answer. Roscoe, I said. She looked up at me, waited. What are you going to do? I asked her. She looked at me like it was an odd question. Work my butt off, I guess. She said, there's going to be a lot to do. We're going to have to rebuild this whole town. Maybe we can make something better out of it, create something worthwhile. And I can play a big part in it. I'll move up the totem pole a couple of notches. I'm really excited. I'm looking forward to it. This is my town, and I'm going to be really involved in it. Maybe I'll get on the town board. Maybe I'll even run for mayor. That would be a hell of a thing, wouldn't it? After all these years, a Roscoe for mayor instead of a Teal? I looked at her. It was a great answer, but it was the wrong answer. Wrong for me. I didn't want to try to change her mind. I didn't want to put any kind of pressure on her at all. That's why I had asked her straight out, before I told her what I was going to have to do. I had wanted her honest, natural response, and I had got it. It was right for her. This was her town. If anybody could fix it, she could. If anybody should stick around working her butt off, she should. But it was the wrong answer for me. Because I knew by then I had to go. I knew by then that I had to get out, fast. The problem was what was going to happen next. The whole thing had gotten out of hand. Before, it had all been about Joe. It had been private. Now it was public. It was like those half-burnt dollar bills. It was scattered all over the damn place. Roscoe had mentioned the governor, the Treasury Department, the National Guard, the State Police, the FBI, Atlanta Fire Investigators, a half dozen competent agencies, all looking at what had gone on in Margrave. And they'd be looking hard. They'd be calling Kleiner the counterfeiter of the century. They'd find out the mayor had disappeared. They'd find out that four police officers had been involved. The FBI would be looking for Picard. Interpol would get involved because of the Venezuela connection. The heat would be tremendous. There would be six agencies competing like mad to get a result. They'd tear the place apart. And one or another of them would snarl me up. I was a stranger, in the wrong place, at the wrong time. It would take about a minute and a half to realize I was the brother of the dead government investigator who had started the whole thing off. They'd look at my agenda.
somebody would think revenge. I would be hauled in, and they would go to work on me. I wouldn't be convicted. There was no risk of that. There was no evidence hanging around. I'd been careful every step of the way. And I knew how to bullshit. They could talk to me until I grew a long white beard, and they wouldn't get anything from me. That was for sure. But they'd try. They'd try like crazy. They'd keep me 2 years in Warburton. 2 years up there on the holding floor. 2 years of my life. That was the problem. No way could I stand still for that. I had only just got my life back. I'd had 6 months of freedom in 36 years. Those 6 months had been the happiest months I'd ever had. So I was getting out before any of them ever knew I'd been there in the first place. My mind was made up. I had to become invisible again. I had to get far away from the Margrave spotlight, where those diligent agencies would never look. It meant my dreams of a future with Roscoe were going to be snuffed out before they were even started. It meant I had to tell Roscoe she wasn't worth gambling 2 years of my life for. I had to tell her that. We talked about it all night. We didn't fall out over it, just talked about it. She knew what I was going to do was right for me. I knew what she was going to do was right for her. She asked me to stay. I thought hard, but said no. I asked her to come with me. She thought hard, but said no. Nothing more to say. Then we talked about other things. We talked about what I would be doing and what she would be doing. And I slowly realized that staying there would tear me apart just as much as leaving was going to, because I didn't want the stuff she was talking about. I didn't want elections and mayors and votes and boards and committees. I didn't want property taxes and maintenance and chambers of commerce and strategies. I didn't want to be sitting there all bored and chafing. Not with the tiny resentments and guilts and disapprovals growing bigger and bigger until they choked us. I wanted what I was talking about. I wanted the open road and a new place every day. I wanted miles to travel and absolutely no idea where I was going. I wanted to ramble. I had rambling on my mind. We sat around talking, miserable, until dawn. I asked her to do one last thing for me. I asked her to arrange a funeral for Joe. I told her I wanted Finley to be there, and the Hubbles, and the two old barbers, and her. I told her to ask the old guy's sister to be there and sing a sad song for Joe. I told her to ask the old lady where the medal was, where she had sung along with Blind Blake's guitar 62 years ago. I asked her to scatter Joe's ashes on the grass there. Roscoe drove me down to Macon in the Bentley. 7 in the morning. We hadn't slept at all. The trip took us an hour. I sat in the back, behind the new black glass. I didn't want anybody to see me. We drove up the rise from her place and threaded through traffic. The whole town was getting packed. Even before we got up to Main Street, I could see the place was swarming. There were dozens of cars parked up everywhere. There were television trucks from the networks and CNN. I hunched down in the back of the car. People were crowding everywhere, even at 7 in the morning. There were ranks of dark blue government sedans all over. We turned at the corner where the coffee shop was. People were lining up on the sidewalk, waiting to get in for breakfast. We drove through the sunny town. Main Street was parked solid. There were vehicles up on the sidewalks. I saw fire chiefs' cars and state police cruisers. I glanced into the barber shop as we crawled past, but the old guys weren't there. I would miss them. I would miss old Finley. I would always wonder how things turned out for him. Good luck, Harvard guy, I thought. Good luck, too, to the Hubbles. This morning was the start of a long road for them. They were going to need a lot of luck. Good luck, too, to Roscoe. I sat there, silently wishing her the best of everything. She deserved it. She really did. She drove me all the way south to Macon. She found the bus depot, parked up, handed me a small envelope, told me not to open it right away. I put it in my pocket, kissed her goodbye, got out of the car, didn't look back. I heard the sound of the big tires on the pavement, and I knew she was gone. I walked into the depot, bought a ticket. Then I crossed the street to a cheap store and bought new clothes. Changed in their cubicle, left the filthy old fatigues in their garbage can. Then I strolled back and got on a bus for California. I had tears in my eyes for more than 100 miles. Then the old bus rattled over the state line. I looked out at the southeast corner of Alabama, opened Roscoe's envelope. It was the photograph of Joe. She had taken it from Molly Beth's valise, taken it out of the frame, trimmed it with scissors to fit my pocket. On the back she had written her telephone number. But I didn't need that. I had already committed it to memory. This is Dick Hill. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Killing Floor by Lee Child. Executive Producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 1997 by Lee Child. Production copyright 2015, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.